Welcome to The Wagon, presented by Sport Clips, the official podcast of the Canadian Football League.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to The Waggle Podcast, brought to you by us here at the CFL and brought to you by our good friends at Sport Clips. Yes, every Waggle Podcast is brought to you by our friends at Sport Clips, who are known for their Sport Clips MVP haircut experience, which includes shampoos massaged into your scalp, hot steam towels, and sports on TV like football, hockey, basketball, baseball, oh, and of course, legendary haircuts. Very good to be a guy. It is very good to be a Sport Clips guy. Visit your local Sport Clips when you can. But thank you for listening to this right now, because we've got a really good waggle and we've got some really good football news to actually talk about. We are going to break down the pending free agents in this CFL. That list is now on CFL.ca. Make sure you log on to see who could be joining or leaving your favorite club. Now, don't get too excited. Free agency isn't until mid-February, but we can talk now. We can break down the big names and the real needs for different teams across the league and how this very, very different season is going to have a different spin to free agency. And who else better to break it down for us than Chris O'Leary, who is always the first to contextualize the big free agent signings every offseason, and this year will be no different. Later in the program, we catch up with a guy who was a big free agent himself, but decided to play his great football in BC, so much so that they won a 2011 Grey Cup. That would be Travis Lule. He was recently on our remote reunion series driven by Kubota. We got together the 2011 BC Lions that won a Grey Cup. And I'm talking about Mike Riley, who was Travis's backup, Corey Banks, the ball hawk, Ryan Phillips in the same secondary, and Superman himself, G. Roy Simon. So we talked to Travis about maybe some of the behind-the-scenes stories about why that team was so great. All that on the waggle. But up next, Chris O'Leary on free agency in 2021. And we bring into the conversation on the waggle the person who we go to when we don't really understand something, so we have them explain it to us. That would be Chris O'Leary, managing editor and senior writer at CFL.ca. He's also written a bunch of great basketball content of late, so make sure you're following at O'Leary Chris on Twitter. Chris, how are you, pal?
I'm doing good, Donovan. Thanks for having me on, and hopefully I can clear some things up. I'm on the spot here, so we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, well, evidently everyone in the CFL is a free agent, as the list of upcoming free agents has now been posted. Go to CFL.ca to see who are the impending free agents for your favorite team. It's basically like a manifesto. The list would be shorter if the list was who isn't a free agent, which is not actually true, but that's the way it seemed to me, as it was overwhelming to just sift through it. And naturally it was going to be a bit bigger because, you know, you didn't have guys make teams and there was no training camp. And so the rosters weren't pared down to then, have, you know, less free agents on the back end. Maybe when you looked at the lists multiple, was there anything that jumped out to you?
I think just the idea that, like you had said, like, you know, you go through a training camp, you go through a season, and rosters inevitably are pared down. And, you know, you come out of that season good or bad, whether you've won 3 games or 15, and you have a sense of what your team is. And, you know, I think to me, it's really interesting that we're going to go into this free agency period with no teams really knowing that. And, you know, I think the teams have been historically good for the last few years. You know, I think like Winnipeg, Hamilton, Calgary, you know, they have a good sense of their identity. And then there are other teams, probably the rest, just off the top of my head, thinking that you don't know, right? I mean, I feel like every season in the CFL, at the best of times, is kind of a crapshoot for most teams, where, you know, you might be really good, or you could have a whole bunch of things go wrong and be really bad. And you don't know until you get on the field. So to not have that, to not have an overwhelming sense of who your team is and where it's at, I think is going to be a big challenge for every GM. And even the three teams that I mentioned that are established, I think it's going to be tough just to not have been able to evaluate your talent and have that sense at the end of the season of who you are. So I'm looking forward to that. And I think at the same time, I kind of feel bad for the GMs that they sort of have to go through this and just sort of, there's a blindness to it, I think, in a sense where you've got to balance what you were going into with a year ago in the season versus, you know, your needs for a season where things are kind of up in the air and there are a lot of question marks.
Yeah, I'm actually fascinated by that as well. You know, you are trying to address needs based off of how you play normally in free agent and evaluate your roster, and you didn't win or lose any games. You weren't really good or bad at anything. You're just a year older. There's, when you look at the teams that were good the last time football was played, there's been some continuity on those staffs. Certainly the two teams in the Grey Cup, Hamilton and Winnipeg, Saskatchewan and Calgary. But then there's a lot of change. New front office in Montreal, new head coach in Ottawa, somewhat new front office and certainly new head coach in Toronto. You got a new head coach in Edmonton. You've got a new head coach and now new front office in BC. How do you think that plays into a factor that, you know, those groups have had a year to evaluate what the roster was going to be, but now have a fresh opportunity in this new abnormal free agency to go continue to rebuild the teams in a new image?
Yeah, I mean, just looking at the lists, I feel like BC kind of fell into that for me, and I think they're in an especially unique situation, just because I think when you look at all the teams, I think GMs are probably going to approach it as they all have their guys. And, you know, when I look at that BC roster, you know, I see one that's constructed to what Ed Hervey had wanted. And obviously Ed's now not part of the picture in BC. And so they have Ed Hervey's roster, and now, you know, Rick Campbell and Neil McAvoy and the BC football ops crew kind of will take the next few months to put their stamp on it and sort of build the roster the way that they think it'll work. So I wonder if there'll be some changes there, just in the sense that everyone has their guys and their players that they like, that they'll want on their roster, just as guys that they can lean on. And, you know, and then I think you look at the other teams that you mentioned, Montreal, Ottawa, Toronto, Edmonton, I would expect that mentality of just, you go with what you know, and guys that you can trust and guys that you've had success with and guys that you know what they bring to practice every day, what they bring to the atmosphere in a locker room, how they help, if it's a vet, how they help a young guy. You know, I think those things might be even more important this year than they have been in years past, just when I think you're going to want to have some level of familiarity so you can hopefully hit the ground and kind of get off to a good start when things get going next year.
Yeah, sometimes in the CFL, you know, a new player coming into the league has been scouted. You only see some of their strengths and not their warts yet. Get maybe overvalued relative to guys who have been in the league. But I think, to your point, guys who have a bit of a track record and understand the cadence of the league will be certainly valuable, because you don't necessarily know what training camp's going to look like. You certainly don't know, you know, what the season's going to look like, so having a base of knowledge is big. Montreal and Edmonton with nearly 50 free agents. Do you expect to see a lot of free agents just resign back with the same teams because 365 days have passed, but the circumstances with which they signed there in the first place haven't changed? Or do you think it's going to be very fluid?
I mean, I feel like I could make an argument for both. I mean, I would think that on one side, you would want to kind of explore what you had signed up for, right? And, you know, maybe it just comes down to money for a lot of guys, especially younger players that are just getting going, over money and opportunity. I feel like if there's a comfort or a desire to go back and see what you'd signed up for and explore that, I think some players will do that. And then at the same time, I think all it'll take is, like in any free agency, one move or a set of moves that kind of create openings, and you'll start to see guys you know, kind of scramble to fill those gaps and see opportunities somewhere else. So, I guess my straight answer is I don't really know. And I think it's just going to be one of the factors of this free agency that kind of make it, I mean, I feel like we've said unprecedented millions of times this year. And I feel like this free agency might be that too. It's just that there's so many different dynamics at play. And I feel like anything could happen. You might want comfort. You might want security. At the same time, maybe you see an opportunity somewhere else and you chase after that.
You mentioned the two words, comfort and security, and that makes me think of Toronto, who had a lot of local guys signed as free agents last year. A lot of those local guys now have to be signed again. I wonder if we see something similar where you see a lot of, in terms of the Canadians, local guys signing with teams close to their family, because in a time where, you know, you have to be close to your family, or you want to be, certainly, that might be of interest. That's a trend that I'm personally looking for. Do you think there might be some credence into that?
I think so. And I think with the Argos, especially, I just think from those local guys, I mean, we saw Nataya Jay and Juwan Breskison, you know, I've spoken with them a few times throughout this past year. And there was just so much excitement about getting those Toronto guys, those GTA guys in a locker room together and getting out on the field and just trying to grow football in Toronto. I would think they would want to see that through and kind of see what they can do with it and what that team can do together. Just going through the list, you know, I saw guys that that jumped out to me. A former Argo, Jimmy Ralph, had signed with Edmonton over free agency 2020. And, you know, he's from Raymond, Alberta, a very small, very tight-knit football community that produces an amazing amount of CFL players and just great football players in general, and basketball players too. I wonder if somebody like Jimmy Ralph would look at Calgary and just get a little bit closer to home, like you said, and just to be a little closer to family and just to be back in Southern Alberta. I think that makes a lot of sense.
The other thing, you know, that this is certainly a consideration as you look through this list is how many players, and we talked about the value of veterans, that's a double-edged sword. How many players, given a full year off where many have had to find other employment, and given either not having the same level of desire to train through the uncertainty, or maybe just closing that chapter in their life, how many will move on and be no longer free agents? They will retire and transition into something else.
Yeah, I think there is potential. And I think it's something that it came up on the coaches call during the Grey Cup Unite week. I think it was either Rick Campbell or I think Dave Dickinson had said that, you know, they're anticipating that some players might not want to continue playing football. And I don't know that there's a specific, I feel like it's unfair for me to, you know, pin it on one person or certain people that I think would not come back. But I definitely think there's a prototype. I mean, if you look at a veteran player who's had a rewarding career, you know, maybe has young kids and has struggled, you know, over the last few seasons, maybe with just the idea of being away from their family and things like that, you know, who maybe over the last year started a new career or gone full time into something they were juggling part time with football. To me, that's a prime candidate. And you know, I don't know how many guys will see take that option, but it definitely wouldn't surprise me if we started to see, you know, teams making announcements, you know, and maybe it's as far off as, you know, a week before training camp opens and players just deciding, you know what, like, I've moved on with life. I've had a good run with football, and you know, this kind of has segued them into that second post-football life. That wouldn't surprise me at all. Who they are, I don't know exactly, but I think there will be a few for sure.
Well, let's talk about the big names, because that's really the driver in terms of the push alerts that people look for, the big splashes in free agency, even though it hasn't necessarily aligned with winning. Certainly in the off seasons, we love to see teams make a big splash in free agency. Who are the big names that you're really intrigued about where they might land?
I mean, just going through, I mean, I looked at Hamilton and, you know, I think there are obviously big names there. Speedy Banks, Simone Lawrence is one of them, Jeremiah Masoli. I remember speaking with Speedy at Grey Cup Week a year ago, and he basically said he would never play anywhere else other than Hamilton. So, I mean, I think his contract coming up isn't really a reason for fans to worry there. I get the same feeling from Simone Lawrence that he wants to play his whole career there. Masoli's interesting to me. I think he also wants to be in Hamilton, but you know, they have that dynamic with Dane Evans, who's a younger quarterback. He's still under contract. He played great when Masoli was hurt. You know, I think the Ticats are happy. I know based on the conversations I've had with their co-GMs over the last year that they love that two quarterback setup. And, you know, I think they'd want to entertain that as long as they could. But, you know, I wonder if Masoli would look at his options and explore what's there. But again, I think with a team like Hamilton, they have so much talent. And I've mentioned three names, and then I'm looking at a list that I drew up of like at least a dozen players that are difference makers on teams. You know, I think they're so close. They had such a heartbreaking loss in the Grey Cup. You know, I think the core of that team will want to come back and try and take that final step together and win a Grey Cup, especially with the Grey Cup being in Hamilton next year. But yeah, at the same time, you know, it is a good team. And I think other teams look at that roster and see free agents, you know, a young guy like Jalen Acklin, another Canadian running back like Sean Thomas Erlington, who I think was on the verge of breaking out. He had put together, I think, three or four really impressive games before he got hurt. And, you know, I think teams will want to pick away at that. So I think that'll be interesting. You know, I look at Winnipeg, their O-line, a lot of key pieces there. Stanley Bryant, Marcus Hardrick, Pat Neufeld, you know, and the guy they're protecting, Andrew Harris. You know, I don't expect Andrew Harris to play anywhere else. But, you know, that those are all going to be big priorities for the Bombers. Yeah, I mean, almost every team has either a star player, a top-end player in the league, or a guy that's just on the verge of doing it. I mean, look at BC, and there's Brian Burnham, Edmonton, Kweku Boateng, who, you know, may not be a household name in the league, but he should be. I mean, he's just, you know, probably the best young defensive lineman with this huge, bright future in front of him. Is a free agent again. Yeah, you could go across the way looking at Edmonton. Greg Ellingson is the guy that they're going to have to re-sign. Sir Vincent Rogers didn't get to play last year, or in 2019. But, you know, was supposed to be a key piece of that offensive line protecting Trevor Harris. You know, I think they'll have to lock him down. And then, you know, that like Omondo Sewell, who I would assume, again, is one of those guys that wants to finish his career in Edmonton. But, you know, we'll have to weigh his options and work that out. But, yeah, I mean, across the board, there's interesting players. Henok Mwamba in Montreal, I think, is, you know, kind of the anchor of that defense. And they were, I think, on the verge of doing something great, and then, you know, the season being canceled kind of disrupts that. So I think he's going to be a priority for them. Yeah, there's so many. I mean, I think every team has a major need. I look at Calgary, Kamar Jordan, Jamar Wall, Eric Rogers, a good veteran receiver. It's I think every team is going to have a top end priority guy to lock down in free agency.
It's funny you mentioned Masoli and he's one guy who, when I think about him, I think about the fact that I wonder if he is even more coveted now than he was in free agency a year ago, because you are just 12 months further removed from his knee injury, you know, something that teams certainly had questions about how ready he would be by training camp and if he'd be able to start the season healthy. And you know, with reconstructive knee surgeries, we kind of know that, like, sometimes your second year is when you're back. I mean, you're fully yourself that first year. And a player with where his legs matter, I wonder if he's more intriguing now than he was when you can take another look at his scans and see that he's doing well. There's another aspect of guys who may have more play in this offseason and might have a better time. Guys who are free agents now, that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to sign with another team in the CFL. That means that they could explore NFL opportunities. Are there any names that are on that list for you that could be cases where guys find employment down south?
I mean, other than, like, you know, you have those years where, you know, like Darrell Walker was dominating. Brandon Zylstra had a great year and, you know, seemed like a shoe-in for the NFL. I mean, I think it's always that delicate balance, right? Like, you need to be the right age. You need to be in your still early, maybe mid-20s, and have a ton of upside. I wonder about Lewis Ward, just because he was such an effective kicker for the Red Blacks. And I mean, and to me, that kicker position just seems like, I don't want to say the most seamless transition to the NFL, but it seems like one that can be made fairly, not, yeah, I don't want to say easily, but it's one that works, I think. And we've seen it with other kickers that have gone to the NFL and found some success. Is there one that jumps out to you?
No, I didn't have one, which is why I asked. But Lewis Ward is a great one, actually, that I didn't think of. I mean, just look at the numbers alone. Never mind. And he does, I mean, he's clearly very accurate, but he does have a strong leg, which would play. So yeah, that's a great one.
Yeah, and he's 28, right? So I mean, you in theory, if you're an NFL team, you're looking for a guy that could do this for a few years, and you can get a 2 or 3 year deal. He's to me, he'd be intriguing.
Yeah, I mean, 28 is a baby for kickers, right? Who can kick well, you know, late into their 30s, and you know, in few examples, even longer than that. Lastly, as I allow you to step out of the hot seat, and I stop peppering you with questions, trying to stump you about a long list of free agents, what are you looking forward to most about 2021? Other than the fact that it's no longer 2020, which is in many different ways, but in terms of you know, this new season, this new I guess lease on life as CFL fans and you know, lovers of the Canadian game, what, as we move forward into the next season, are you most looking forward to, and what are you most intrigued about seeing how it plays out?
I think what I'm most looking forward to, and this isn't really a football specific answer, even though it's about football, it's just, and I think I've written about it a couple of times, and I know I've talked about it with friends and stuff a lot over the last few months, probably like everyone has. It's just almost the kind of like the white noise of our lives that we've kind of lost through the pandemic, right? I mean, I think about just small things like just being able to be, the idea of being able to be around people again in an everyday capacity, whether it's going to a practice, doing interviews, you know, sitting with other reporters, watching practice, things like that, going to games and just being around people, you know, even if you're not directly interacting with them, just crowds and just the buzz that creates and the energy that creates. Like we've gone 8 or 9 months, it feels like, you know, 30 or 40 months without that. And to me, that's exciting. Just getting back to, I think, just the sense of community that sports brings when people go to watch things together. And, you know, I think that's going to be appreciated in a way that we just, you know, you couldn't help but take for granted before it was your normal to get it back. I think, you know, however we get it back, whether it's reduced crowds or, you know, if people are still wearing masks or distancing in some way, whatever, I think that's exciting. And then on the field, yeah, just seeing how teams roll out and what they do. You know, there were, you could look at each team and kind of have a reason to be optimistic, I think. You know, I think about the Lions, who were so bad in 2019 and seemed like they had made some substantial moves, and they've made even more just in terms of, like you said, the front office. And, you know, we'll get to see Rick Campbell with his coaching staff out on the field, and see what that team can do. You know, I mentioned the Alouettes, a team that I had followed closely in 2019, and just the massive turnaround they made there, and they just had such a cool culture, and it seemed like they were really building something. I wonder how that's going to be affected after a year away. And, you know, there's obviously, I think, going to be new players coming in, just all the change around that. Yeah. I think there's so much opportunity for every team. You know, we talked about Toronto and can their kind of local guys project work and bring them success on the field. I'm excited, and just, and, you know, and I think something I wrote about last week during Grey Cup United, just thinking about this time next year and what a Grey Cup could be like, what the playoffs could be like, and just, you know, assuming everything goes the way it's looking like it will, that, you know, just that everyone's together and just kind of just the energy around sports and the CFL will be fun. And I think it'll be something that we'll appreciate in a way that we just couldn't have before.
Yeah, that's well said. I'm looking forward to, this might sound like an odd choice, but I'm looking forward to a city or community, or in some cases province, being able to like celebrate something, right? Like ultimately, yeah, Someone's going to win the Grey Cup, right? It's going to be handed out, and whether it's, you know, a team that's done it before in recent memory, like Calgary, and them extending their real, you know, sustained success and dominance into, you know, a new decade, or it's a team that hasn't won it in a long time, in Hamilton, you know, having 2 years in a row, or two Grey Cups in a row of teams ending the streak. I'm just excited for, you know, what that fan base gets to experience, and then what, you know, that narrative that comes with winning it is. So that's kind of what I'm looking forward to. What I'm actually intrigued about is, because our world is already certainly different, there's certainly in all sectors ways where we can tell, you know, life is going to be different moving forward. Whenever we get to our new normal and out of this abnormal, we'll have a better sense of what that looks like. But I'm interested to see what that means for the Canadian game, right? Like, you know, is virtual reality and that experience going to be something that pops off as a way to interact with teams? Is it going to be different, you know, being in a packed stadium? Or is, you know, a Friday night or a Saturday going to be cheat day and the day that you allow yourself to be part of that community? Because, you know, you need that itch scratch, because the rest of our lives we're kind of, you know, still having a shelter in place, work from home mentality. I'm interested to see, what the residue of the pandemic that we're currently in and may very well still be in to a certain extent when the season starts. I'm interested to see how that impacts the game and how we interact with it. So lots to be intrigued and looking forward to. Right now, the thing that people are certainly intrigued about is, you know, not just that list of free agents, but where they will land and what that will mean for their clubs. And there's no better person to follow to get that story, or really any story, than Chris O'Leary. Give him a follow on Twitter at O'Leary Chris. His byline is all over the website all of that time. So we appreciate him taking some time for this conversation. Thanks so much, Chris.
Absolutely, man. Thanks for having me.
So that was Chris O'Leary on all things free agency. Maybe I'll ask our next guest about free agency and how he dealt with it. We know a teammate of his, Mike Riley, got the bag in free agency. That would be Travis Lule. He's coming up next on The Waggle. So as you know, on The Waggle, we have been revisiting some of the great conversations and videos we've had on the website, celebrating some great players, some great teams, great memories in the CFL. That's what we've endeavored to do with our remote reunion series driven by Kubota. And so we're trying to revisit those remote reunions, and we'll do that right here with Travis Lule, who was a big part not only of the Grey Cup, but also of that reunion with a couple of his teammates of mine and legends in the of game, Mike Riley, Corey Banks, Ryan Phillips, Giroy Simon, and yourself. And when you get back, Travis, to being around those guys virtually now, as we're all doing things now and telling stories, what's that like for you?
Pretty darn fun, actually. You know, some of those guys I haven't talked to in a good bit of time. Obviously, I've been in touch with Mike Riley, and up until recently, you know, I was still working for the club, so I still spoke with G-Roy regularly. But to be able to, you know, tap in and hear Corey Banks cracking a few jokes and Cron Williams and those guys who I, you know, touch base with just a handful of times a year, normally just, you know, a text or a social media shout or something. It's pretty dang fun. It reminds you of, you know, kind of the camaraderie that we had on that team. And every championship team has that story, right? Where the locker, you had a good locker room. You can't win if you don't have a good locker room. So it's just kind of fun, especially now in hindsight, to look back and, you know, think of those memories along the way. It's pretty dang fun.
Yeah. And you guys had a lot of characters, a lot of different characters, a lot of impact players on that team, you know, just looking at it from, you know, Paul McCallum on one end of the spectrum to an Andrew Harris, a younger Andrew Harris, obviously, your quarterback room with Jarius Jackson, yourself, Mike Riley, who all did great things individually. Saul and Adam Big Hill in the middle of the field as linebackers. You know, Brent Johnson, one of the best Canadian defensive linemen of all time. It was cast of characters. If you know, could play producer and you could add one person to that group that we didn't hear from, but the fans across the CFL would have really benefited from, who would it be?
Oh man, like you say, that really was a room of characters. I mean, just hearing the banter between Dante Marsh, Ryan Phillips, and Corey Banks, you could let the three of them go and talk for hours and people would be entertained by that. Who else was on there or wasn't on there? I mean, Jamal Robertson is kind of gets lost in the shuffle. He was just an awesome teammate. He was a starter to begin that year, and he kind of sidestepped for Andrew Harris, who really kind of came of age at the end of that season. But he was a fun character, high character guy, awesome teammate. You really could take Paris Jackson. I mean, you know, just a really kind of boisterous, outgoing personality who had kind of taken a step back to some younger guys and then stepped in some critical moments. He had a big catch in that Grey Cup game. He was just another, you know, good veteran guy who accepted his role that year and played at a high level when he needed him to. But all those guys were great in front of the camera too, right? So it'd been fun to line all those guys. Arlen Bruce, are you kidding me? Arlen Bruce is one of the league's great, kind of polarizing figures at times, but he was an awesome teammate for us. And always an entertaining guy to put in front of a microphone. You never knew exactly what he'd say, but made some huge plays, some of the most critical plays of that season for us. So the list goes on and on.
Yeah, and I love that you named a couple of receivers, because just looking at your depth chart, the one thing that jumps out at me, other than the quarterback room and all the knowledge in it, and all the yards, quite frankly, that were in it, was your receivers, right? Like, obviously everyone knows about G-Roy, but Paris Jackson, Sean Gore, Ryan Thelwell, Marco Iannuzzi, Akeem Foster, Arlen Bruce. Like, you had some good, import and non-import were the terms at the time, talent back then. What was it like for you to sling it to that group of guys?
Yeah, I tell you what, that group grew up a lot that year, because if you look in hindsight and you know those names, and a lot of those guys went on to, have really nice careers. But at the beginning of that season, we lined up in Montreal in week one, and Montreal was the two-time defending champs at the time, so they were like the kings of the league prior to that 11 season. And in our first game, I lined up with G-Roy Simon and four receivers who hadn't caught a ball yet in the CFL. At the time, it was Sean Gore, who had just barely touched the field in 2010. Mark Iannuzzi was a rookie. Akeem Foster, I think, was a second-year player, but hadn't played meaningful minutes the season before. Marco wasn't starting yet. So that first game, it would have been Nick Moore actually started. Akeem Foster, who actually caught a touchdown pass in that game, his first career one, that first game, week one in Montreal in 11. Sean Gore, who we asked a lot of Sean Gore at the beginning of that season. Then we had a young man by the name of Dobson Collins, who started the season for us at X, and he only played five or six games, and it didn't quite work out. And so anyways, we shuffled the wide receiver crew around a lot that year, and really that's why Arlen Bruce became such a big part of the story, because it was G-Roy kind of shouldering the load with some younger guys, and it was hard to get him the ball and get him the same kind of touches, because teams could kind of key that. And Sean Gore had a lot of looks the first couple weeks of the season, but it wasn't really until we brought in Arlen Bruce and we kind of balanced the field out, and he typically played opposite of G-Roy, and now you've got two legit guys who, kind of opened and made all the rest of the group better, including myself, just because we had a more balanced lineup and can kind of let those other guys grow at the pace that is more natural and entirely help the team. So there's no question we had a really good wide receiver crew, but it took some growing up for us to really gel, and that's part of the slow start that year. I mean, even I know we scored some points in that those first five games. We lost four of those five games. We had leads in the fourth quarter, so it was like we were close, but we weren't quite there, and it didn't really start to happen, didn't really start to click to find ways to win and get that one extra score we needed to win some of those early close ball games until after we got Arlen.
Yeah, you mentioned it, and I'm glad you went there. So let's talk about it. Starting 0-5, first team ever to start 0-5 and end up in first place, first team ever to start 0-5 and win a Grey Cup. End up, you know, being 11-7, go 11-2 down the stretch, and then obviously run the table in the playoffs. For many organizations and teams, 0-5, it's a wrap. Week six, you're thinking about, you know, 1-2-3 Cancun would break the huddles. You guys clearly weren't that way. Why?
Yeah, well, you know, a couple things. I think we were better than 0-5. So I was like, come on, guys, you know, like this isn't representative of who we think we are. And our you know, I really don't think we're that bad. We look around the locker room, we're not, like, you know, most of us are self-aware. And I mean, I've, you know, been on teams that underperformed. You look around the locker room going like, man, this is going to be hard to dig out of this hole. I don't know how good of a team we are. That team was like, no, we're better than this. You know, like, what do we got to do to make it go? And, but, you know, that can't happen without really good leadership. And I look back on that year a lot and think, if it was, say, it was a different state of an organization where Wally didn't have the complete trust of David Braley and the credibility behind Wally's name. So David could trust Wally and wasn't going to make a, you know, he's not going to fire the head coach. Because going into that year, there was a ton of expectation for us. We're host team in the Grey Cup. We had come on strong in the back half of 2010. So there was reason to be excited about our team. So that 0-5 was really, really disappointing and surprising. And, you know, people were looking for answers. And, you know, in a lot of organizations, or, you know, if management was structured differently or whatnot, you know, there would have been changes made, whether you're firing a head coach or a coordinator or benching your starting quarterback, you know, like those are the types of big changes that happen when a team starts off that poorly. But we just kind of stayed the course, and Wally had a vision for what we were, and we just had a few pieces come in, and Tad Cornegay came on the defensive side of the ball and kind of solidified things. I think Kareem Rush solidified the defensive line, and the pass rush that we had that was so really ferocious in the second half of that season allowed those guys to rotate with Brent Johnson and Khalif Mitchell and Aaron Hunt. So we just had a lot of good players, but a couple of key acquisitions helped us kind of solidify into the team. Wally stayed the course. You know, we didn't dramatically change the offense, incorporated Andrew Harris a little bit more. I maybe made a few more plays with my feet, and and we started to win, and it started to click. And so it was like, okay, well, this is where we were, but we were in such a hole. The other part of it was, in the CFL, obviously the teams that are in front of you are on your schedule down the road. So we knew we had Edmonton three more times. Edmonton was leading the league. I think they were 5-0 and we were 0-5. So, we had them three more games against Edmonton. We had two more games against Calgary. Yeah, obviously, anytime you're beating them, you're getting, you know, you're moving two games in the standing instead of one. So it's like, we're down, but we're not out, because we can beat those teams in front of us. And so that's what started to happen. We started to beat them. You know, they would lose, we would win, we'd get closer to them. And we finally got over the hump where, you know, we held the tiebreaker over all those teams in a what ended up as a three-way tie in the West Division.
The other thing you had working against you was, you know, you're playing at Empire Field. You weren't in the new BC yeah. place to start the season. And there was some, as I remember it, correct me if I'm wrong, because you were in it, there was some uncertainty as to when you might be into BC place, because construction at the best of times is tough to predict, knowing that at the end of the year, the Grey Cup, you know, was going to be there. What was that like, you know, transitioning from one stadium to another, one city to another, one surface to another midway through the season?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think, we were all under the impression that 2010 was going to be the one season we played at Empire. And so it probably wasn't until, I don't remember the exact date, but into the spring when it was obvious that that wasn't going to happen. So they were going to leave the temporary setup at Empire Field, and we would play, you know, however many games there. I don't even remember if that was determined before the season or exactly when they said, okay, here's the start date we're shooting for in September. But it had a very different feel to it, right? BC Place was home, and BC Place was where, you know, the veteran core of that team had won so many games and was comfortable, and you're used to the locker rooms and, you know, the game day routine. And so, you know, driving out to, you know, into Burnaby on Vancouver's east side, parking across the street, literally walking across Hastings Street, you know, to get to the modular locker rooms, and then, you know, go on a half mile walk down a ramp to the stadium. And so it was just a very different feel. And to be honest, it was kind of cool, like game day, and actually the vibe inside Empire even the temporary empire was pretty cool. And a lot of longtime Lions fans, you know, point out that, you know, they did a pretty good job of kind of recreating the environment down there. But just the creature comforts of playing in your home stadium, it didn't feel like we were. It felt very much like a temporary thing. So there was a ton of excitement moving back to BC Place. And it just kind of coincided with us starting to play better football, right? And it actually worked in our favor because there were so many people that were excited to see the new BC Place, right? This was a $500 million renovation that happened, and people were excited to see it. And so the fact that we had some momentum behind us and was like, hey, let's go support the Lions. Shoot, we want to see the stadium. And they, you know, and so we just had, you know, we're playing regular season games and, you know, in front of 50,000, 45,000 people, which, you know, isn't commonplace. So, you know, having all of that, you know, having the crowd behind us, riding that momentum out, it really just kind of pushed us. It was a giant wave of energy that pushed us, in my opinion, all the way to the finish line.
And when you get to that finish line, not only having, you know, the home field advantage and, you know, lots of support locally and in the building that night, but then also being able, you know, to seal the deal and win it and you know, make it a storybook ending. What was that like to do it at home?
Yeah. I mean, it was just special, and it gets more special, I think, in hindsight. To kind of back to that point, though, coming as we were gaining all that momentum, as I mentioned, we started the season that year against Montreal. Well, the last regular season game was against Montreal. And again, they're the two-time defending champs. Like, they have an equal record to us or better. They needed to win first place in the East. We needed to win first place in the West. So really, the tension felt really high around that game, at least for me, going, man, you know, this isn't going to be a rollover. If we don't do this, we're going to be third place in the West. If we don't win this final game, and we'll have to go on the road. If we do, we get to stay right in our backyard, you know, for a Western final and then potentially a Grey Cup and never leave this building again, right? So, and when we won that game in pretty convincing fashion, right? We won 43-1 and we scored on our first two possessions, and we put the game out of reach early and held on. So to me, it was that game is where so much of the tension mounted, and really, you know, all of the regular season does, but that game kind of laid a foundation for our expectation for the playoffs. Okay, we just beat that team in that fashion. Like, this is our Grey Cup to win. And I think it just felt that way from that moment on. So, you know, to obviously be able to do it the next week in the West Final in a packed house against Edmonton at home to set up the Grey Cup game in, you know, in our own backyard. I mean, it just very much was. It was a home game for us. I mean, I know fans come from all over the place and there's all different colors in the stands, but it just felt like another home game for us. And, you know, packed house, I mean, just that had that tingle, that championship game feel, you know, where it almost feels surreal in the moment. And, you know, you're just kind of so focused on the task at hand that it all happens. It's almost like a blur, to be perfectly honest with you. The championship game is like a blur. You're dialed in, you're doing what you need to do. And then, you know, clock hits zero and we had won and the confetti comes down. I mean, it was a pretty surreal moment. And we had been in such a tunnel for so long, just, you know, one game at a time, we got to climb out of this hole and boom, all of a sudden we're in the playoffs and boom, it's over and we won it and we did it. And it was kind of like, holy cow, you know, like take a deep breath. I remember walking around the city the next morning, you know, we had obviously had a team hotel downtown and walking around the morning after the game. And, you know, it was Monday morning and some people were going back to work and it was a sunny morning. I remember the sun shining and just kind of smiling on the sideline, like, wow, that wasn't a dream. Like, that really happened last night. Okay, that was pretty cool.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. And it's been really cool to, you know, not just spend this time with you to talk back about it, but seeing you, you know, reminisce about it with teammates, the guys that you kind of formed that brotherhood with and went through and got it done, was really fun. So listeners, make sure you go to the CFL.ca to consume that content. You are still working, but in a different way, especially because you're such a fixture, you know, in BC and in the Vancouver greater area, not just for what you did there as a player, but being in the community, coaching, you know, volunteering in the community, public speaking. But now you've transitioned in a different way post-career, whether it was on the field with the team or helping the team in corporate partnerships. You know, you're joined a different team, a team that you also have a lot of love for, know well, your family team, and you're part of Lule Financial team, helping with some financial planning. What that transition been like as you're now a rookie again?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, no, it has been a change. You know, and it's something that, you know, it's not completely random to me. Obviously, this is something I had considered for a lot of years. My educational background is in finance. That's what I studied in college. This was always kind of my plan, was to see where the pro football thing took me, but then to potentially to move into this. My dad started this financial planning firm, as you mentioned, Lule Financial, and right around the year I was born, actually, in 1984, so just after I was born. And so he's been doing that ever since. And so my brother joined the firm in 2010 after he got married in Montana, moved back to Oregon. So he's been working here with my father for the last 10 years. And, you know, my dad won't work forever. He's getting closer to that retirement age, though he is still full-time here with us now. It was just the succession planning aspect of the business. So I talked to my brother about this for a number of years. And obviously, I didn't know for certain how that would play out. And once my career ended, as you mentioned, I joined the Lions front office working in corporate partnerships on the business side of the club. And I actually did enjoy that quite a bit. Obviously, I just love the organization and my time in Vancouver. But, you know, at the end of it, as my wife and I were, you know, after I retired and we just started, you know, discussing what we wanted the rest of our life to look like, we'd lived away from family and grandparents and things like that for a lot of years. You know, I had opportunities to potentially get into coaching, which is something I really considered, but I'd kind of lived that transient lifestyle for a lot of years as a player, not knowing what, you know, 1, 2, 5 years down the road might look like for you. And I think as a family, we sought a little bit more stability for ourselves and had this opportunity to come home and join my brother in business. And so that's ultimately where, you know, our hearts led us. So it is really good to be home. And especially in this, you know, this 2020 year has been a wild year, but to be back around family kind of validates, you know, that we made the move for the right reason. So I'll forever be indebted to everyone in Vancouver for my time there. You know, and I'm, you know, as soon as border restrictions open up and I can visit, I absolutely will. I have plans to, you know, maintain a bunch of my contacts there in Vancouver. So hopefully I can come up a couple times a year, or however that plays out. But yeah, the transition has been, you know, really has been a lot of new stuff and a new and interesting year. But we're starting to feel settled and feel pretty darn good about where we're at. So,
well, you clearly made a smart move, and as 2020 has taught or reminded us all, you know, the most important thing at all times is family. And there's never a bad time to make sure that your finances are in order. So glad you get to spend some quality time and work with family, and so thankful that you're helping many people with their finances, and love the fact that you're helping CFL fans get over their football fix and get to remember some of the great, great memories that you've had in our league. Thanks so much. Appreciate you doing this.
Absolutely. Thanks, Donovan.
Thanks again to Travis Lule, who's a really good follow on Twitter, at Travis Lule, doing a great job still working with the BC Lions in corporate partnerships, but he did some work on the field, so it was great to listen to him tell some of those stories. And once again, thank you to Chris O'Leary, at O'Leary Chris is his handle on Twitter. We're also on Twitter, at CFL. I am at Donovan Bennett. Let us know. What do you want to hear? Who do you want to hear from? What do you like? What do you not like? We do this for you, so your feedback is very important. And while you're online and giving feedback, make sure to like, favorite, share, and subscribe. 5 stars would be really appreciated, but I'm not going to beg. But we do this for you, certainly, and we enjoy doing it. Hopefully, you enjoyed it as well. Until next time, thanks for listening.
The WAG, presented by SportClips, the official podcast of the Canadian Football League.